This episode of the Gabfest contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for November 7th, 2019, the 1 year from this week edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura here in Washington, D.C. Joining me visually but not physically is Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine, who I'm looking at over Skype. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David.
From Yale. How are you?
I'm good. Glad to be here.
And then joining me, not visually, but telephonically, is John Dickerson of CBS 60 Minutes from New York. Hello, John Dickerson.
Hello, David. Is it telephonically?
I don't know.
Oh, whatever. Come on. All right.
Come on.
Well, I'm
God.
Just, no, it's interesting. Is it radio? Is it a telephone line?
Oh, my God.
It's magic.
It's not telephonic. I can't even believe it.
Stop. I understand it's not telephonic. I'm
oh,
just
my
saying.
God. You're being pedantic already. On today's Gabfest, election results in Kentucky and Virginia embolden Democrats. And then there are discouraging poll results in swing states for Democratic presidential candidates. Then impeachment barrels forward. What happened this week? What is about to happen? And then President Trump withdraws the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. Is that catastrophic or merely terrible? Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. 1 year from this week, we will have elected a new president, or possibly the same president. And this week, we saw the last major elections before 2020 in a bunch of states that weirdly have off-year elections, which are always cute but confusing because you're like, it's an odd year. Why is there an election? But it's still nice to have. And then we also saw some very interesting, and if you're a Democrat, alarming poll results for Democratic primary challenges. So let's start with the 2019 results. John, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the cradle of the Republic, the cradle, in fact, of John Dickerson, Democrats took control of the state Senate and the state House. Why is that important? Why is it overdue? Is it important and overdue?
Well, I think it's important. Well, it's for the first time in 50 years. So that's anytime anything happens for the first time in 50 years, you should take note of it. Basically, most people would say what this does is it ends the charade that Virginia is not a blue state. You know, it went from being red to purple to blue. And so they're saying that it's now a blue state. And that, I don't know what I think about that debate. That's fine. You can have that debate. The most interesting thing, it seems to me, about Virginia, the two most important results are, first of all, that that Republicans did not win back the seats that they lost in 2017 when Democrats had strong showings in Republican areas. And then Democrats won in additional areas to take control over the two state houses. You now have the two state houses and the governorship all in the same party, which means there's going to be a series of legislation passed in Virginia on gun control in particular that'll be very interesting to watch. Why is that interesting? Because of the second thing. So the first point is Democrats are showing strength, Republicans weakness in the exurbs, the areas out suburbs and outside. And that's something we'll talk a lot about because it was also strong for Democrats in Kentucky. And the argument is that if it's been strong consistently in 2018 and 2019, that's bad for Donald Trump. But the second thing that's important in Virginia is it's the home of the NRA. The forces of gun control, gun safety, whatever you want to call it, basically now have beaten the NRA in their own backyard. That will mean a lot for gun legislation in Virginia and for the Everytown organization. It's a model for inroads they might be able to make in other states.
Emily, quickly, let's also hit the other big state for Democrats this week was Kentucky, where a Democrat in a very red state beat the extremely hated incumbent governor Matt Bevin in a state where President Trump campaigned and tried to tie the Democrat Andy Beshear to impeachment. Trump had won the state by 30. Republicans won every single other statewide office that was up. Is Bevin's loss a warning for Trump or not really? Is it just like a particular set of circumstances with an extremely bad and hated incumbent?
I think more of the latter. You know, I wonder if people think differently about the governor in some circumstances than the sort of normal party polarized politics that we have. You know, I'm thinking of the fact that a Democrat is governor in Kansas or a Republican is governor in Massachusetts. There's a way in which that administrative job can, I think, seems a little less political than some other positions. And I mostly just think that, yeah, what you said, there was an extremely unpopular incumbent. It's true that President Trump couldn't save him, but he had been his own worst enemy.
It's a great question, but the what I think will be interesting is if you match the suburban and exurban results in Kentucky with what happened in Virginia and then what happened in the same areas with the same kind of voters in 18, whether it's demonstrably true that that will all play out the same way in 2020, it suggests enough data points that it puts high and heavy uncertainty in the air for Republican senators who are running in 2020 in places that where they're going to depend. I'm thinking of people like Cory Gardner, Susan Collins, running in states where they need those votes. And if Donald Trump and the Republican Party of Donald Trump has consistently been showing weaknesses in those areas, again, whether it actually plays out that way in 2020, I think it's going to make some nervousness and change perhaps some calculations over the next year as Republicans worry about becoming a party that is just defined by the Trump coalition, which is essentially non-college whites, evangelicals, and rural voters. And that nervousness, again, whether it's true or not, will create some potential for some more destabilizing action among Republicans, possibly.
Is it, I had a question about that. John, is John Cornyn up for election in 2020? Yeah, I mean, that's when I look at what John Cornyn is doing, which is to not be as full-throated around impeachment as you nearly would expect, given that he's the number two Republican in the Senate. He's a Texas Republican. That to me is a signal he is very worried that he, you know, he could face something serious.
Again, these linkages we should all, you know, these are drawn in pencil and very lightly, but I would also link it to what I went on at some length about with Mitch McConnell the other a couple of weeks ago when he was asked about the conversation the president said he had with McConnell, and McConnell basically threw the president under the bus. I think you can, if you start to see a number of these things, you see some again, whether the distancing from the president is even possible, I think that's quite hard to do for anybody. But just the more uncertainty and destabilization there is in the world, added to the existing highly destabilizing behavior of the president and the people who are defending him, it just adds more kind of frenetic possibilities in an already pretty frantic political world. As everybody's trying to gauge what the politics are going to look like on election day a year from now, that puts so much uncertainty in the system for Republicans to see this weakness repeated in these areas that used to be part of their coalition.
And yet, if you are Cory Gardner or Susan Collins or even John Cornyn, aren't you kind of caught in a vice? Like, you can try mm-hmm. to put some distance between you and the you know, I would say most like crazy tune defenders of Trump, like Mark Meadows, who just seemed to be saying, I mean, and Lindsey Graham, like, I am in lockstep with the president no matter what he says, I'm going in that direction. They're stepping back from that. But in the end, like, there will presumably be an impeachment trial in the Senate, and it's very hard to imagine them currently voting to remove from office President Trump. Now, I do think that could change. I mean, we saw public approval of President Nixon drastically move downward during the public hearings in Watergate. But I just feel like from the vantage point of right now, I'm not sure. This is like the either angel or devil of being a Trump supporter or a Republican senator in the Trump era. You may be trying to maintain some kind of semblance of separation, but how far is that really going to get you?
Whether a candidate, any candidate can separate themselves in a nationalized election, and we have them even in off years, so of course we're going to have one in 2020, is I think basically most people have been in the game say you can't do it. You can't get out from under a president. However, candidates in fear of not being reelected tend to do things, you know, they throw Hail Mary passes. And, you know, Cory Gardner in Colorado, which is basically a one-third, one-third state, so Democrat, independent Republican split the state in thirds. John Hickenlooper, who he's running against, the former governor and mayor of Denver, is a very popular fellow in the state. So Cory Gardner, you could imagine, again, if even if you stipulate that that you can't get out from under a president, may still try. And why does that matter? Well, that's one guy in one state. Well, first of all, Colorado is a battleground state. Second of all, as we know from this president, when one person does something that he doesn't like, he goes after them. So then it becomes, you could imagine that growing into something more, because then he's attacking a Republican. So what's Mitch McConnell say about that? And so on and so forth. So it's just, as I say, a possibility for destabilization.
I want to touch, Emily, on what is potentially the most alarming aspect of the vote on Tuesday, which is as of Wednesday, I actually didn't look this morning, there was intimations, hints, even open statements from Republican legislators in Kentucky that they might not accept the results of that gubernatorial election. And there's one of the leaders in the Republican House is trying to confect this into a contested election, which it was, you know, about 5,000 votes separating the Democrat and the Republican. And this stunning kind of possibility that the Kentucky legislature, which is dominated by Republicans, might try to overturn the popular vote. I actually don't think this will succeed for a couple of, even if they make a real push at it, which there's no sign they're going to. One is Bevin has been a lousy governor, even for Republicans. He's made them more unpopular. He's been unpopular himself. So why keep him in there? Second, it is actually fun to have a Democratic, a governor of the rival party. In some ways, especially if you have a majority in the legislature, you can really mess with them and score points off of that person. And that's a kind of good way to spend a couple of years sometimes. So it's not that bad to be in the out party if you have the majority in the legislature. But also, I don't think it's effective to cheat in elections after the fact. I think it's very effective to suppress the votes in advance when it can be dressed up as some kind of principle of voter integrity. But after the fact, when the votes are already counted, the numbers are there, it is not. I think it's going to look a lot like cheating if they try to push this through.
Yeah, it would in fact be cheating and like deeply alarming if this happened. You know, I will just note Kentucky already does one thing to suppress the vote, which is to close the polls at 6 p.m. You know, I think that you're right. This isn't going to go anywhere. But the fact that it's even being discussed, it's just these signs we're getting from states. I mean, we've gotten them also from Wisconsin. And of course, like the queen of this is North Carolina, where if you don't like the way the game is being played, you just like throw the board up into the air and all the pieces fall in some other place. You just change the rules. You know, I don't know enough about Kentucky law to know how the governor's powers are distributed and who decides, but you could really imagine this legislature trying to clip the wings of this new Democrat coming in much the way that the North Carolina Republican-dominated legislature has done that for Roy Cooper, the governor there.
Let us turn, my friends, to the polls for the presidential campaign. So from one kind of poll to another kind of poll. There was a really interesting poll in the New York Times of swing states, John, this week, looking at how various Democratic presidential candidates might perform against President Trump in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, North Carolina, Florida, and Arizona. Interesting that Arizona is a very legit swing state in a way that Ohio, for example, doesn't seem to be anymore. Why were Democrats so agitated by the results of this poll? And is this one poll significant?
It's let's see how to pack. Okay, so why were they agitated? Well, they're agitated because Biden's only up by a couple of points over Trump in these six states. Let's see, Sanders was up a little bit and Warren was down. So I think there was agitation for two reasons. One, Biden wasn't up by as much as people thought. Warren was down. And three, and this is the bigger point, I think, is a lot of people think, stop looking at and thinking about the election in that way. Stop basically boiling the entire election down to six states full of larger shares of white working class voters, because that's not what the electorate is about. And implicit in even doing the poll among some Democrats is the idea that they would argue that the Times poll kind of has its thumb on the scale in terms of this larger argument about whether the Democratic Party needs to, quote unquote, moderate to go for the kinds of voters in those six states or go for the kind of voters that might have even been part of the Trump coalition in those six states, or whether the Democratic Party, by being true to its principles and a kind of more liberal vision, can blow through turnout models, change the shape of the electorate in those six states and other places with a kind of Warren or Sanders type candidate.
I have a question about the idea of how significant this poll is a year out. Nate Cohn, right. who's the Times reporter who did the poll and was talking about it, said, hey, a year out is basically just as good as right before the election. And then Nate Silver, the guru of 538, said polls a year out, like, eh, not that reality-based, not that important. What's the answer here?
First of all, the answer is the polling gurus need to get different first names. It's too confusing to have both Nate Cohn and Nate Silver be named Nate.
I think it might be a little late for one of them to actually
Nate Cohn has I don't know Nate Cohn. I've met Nate Silver a couple of times. Nate Cohn is like definitely riding on the coattails of Nate Silver. He's like, oh, what's the hot polling name? It's Nate. I'm gonna glom onto that. And the Times hired him.
I don't think that his parents would appreciate
really?
That.
Are you sure? Are
no,
you positive?
I don't think okay. so. I want to know the answer to this. John, what am I supposed to make of these polls year out, matter, don't matter?
There's a general principle, and then I don't know. I didn't see what Nate Silver of 538 said. I did read in the Times the statement that I have a note here to go check it out and see if that's in fact true or if there's like some important caveat. But yeah, the article that went along with the polling said that on average in the last three cycles, head-to-head polls a year ahead of the election have been as close to the final result as those taken the day before the final result.
I just saw Nate Silver just say, like in a tweet, you know what, polls a year out, eh. But I'm not sure. Anyway.
First of all, there aren't polls taken the day before, I don't think, right?
Because not the day before, whatever.
Right, polls released the day before. But anyway, the broader, more important point is so much changes and happens, you can say that that's been what the result in the past has been. But if there's an instance in which past performance does not predict future results in this current political environment, I think that would be wise to keep in mind in that context. But I do think the idea that if the Electoral College is still in play in our presidential elections, then it is important to look at the states that will matter with respect to the Electoral College. So I think looking at these six states makes sense. And then we should probably turn to this idea of what's the actual electorate going to look like and then who is best set up to make the case with that electorate.
I thought what was the most interesting thing in Nate Cohn's piece accompanying this story about his poll was noting what kind of people seem to be supporting Biden but not Warren or Warren but not Biden.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that you have the category. So, for example, there's Sanders seems to pick up a bunch of young voters when you poll who don't want to then vote for Warren or Biden. And Biden seems to pick up like a lot of people who don't seem to want to vote for a woman, for example. There seems to be a lot of just out and out cold stone sexism in the electorate, which was horrifying to read
about. It was like 40% of the people. There's 6% of the electorate is Biden, not Warren, and 40% of them was answering yes to questions that made them seem like sexist. Questions about the likability of Warren and female candidates in general.
And I've said this before, but this is basically votes in the Democratic primaries and caucuses are going to be about punditry about what your neighbor thinks. So, you know, Democrats are by wide majorities fine with having a woman president, but they don't think that their fellow Democrats are fine with having a woman president, which means when they vote, are they casting a vote for the person they think should do the job? Or are they casting the vote for the person they think will have the best chance in the general election because of people's predispositions about women? And that's what a mess that is. And they're trying to sort that out. Good luck with that.
John, what do you make of the fact that so this poll of swing states included these six states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, North Carolina, Florida, Arizona. It did not include Georgia, Texas, and Ohio, and Iowa. So I think the presumption being that Ohio and Iowa are now basically Republican states and it's going to be they're not really right. swing states. But also there's this at least conversation that I hear among people that Georgia and Texas are potentially in play, and Arizona is certainly in play. It's already polled.
I guess it means it's making some bets on two things. One is that basically the shape of the electorate in Iowa and Ohio is just Democrats are never going to do well enough to reach far enough into the white working class voters in those states or white rural voters in Iowa to beat. Also, you've got a Senate race in Iowa that'll with an incumbent Republican that'll tweak things for the Democrats. And so, although, by the way, we should note, but just as a farm state, we should talk about this. If you look inside the Republican coalition, it seems to me Democrats would have some opportunities. Let's talk about rural voters for a moment. bankruptcies for farms are going to be as high as they've ever been in 2019. The bailout to the farmers is now bigger net than the bailout of the car companies under the Obama administration because of the fight with China and the tariff battles with other countries. If you were a compelling candidate who could make the case to rural voters and you believed, and again, there are some things implicit in what I'm saying that some people don't believe because some people believe these voters are gone, that it's all about identity, not economics, and therefore why should a Democrat spend a lot of time doing that? But back to your basic point, David, the Republican coalition has those two states and the Democratic coalition doesn't have it enough in Georgia and Texas that this cycle they'll be able to make inroads. If you believe in a Warren kind of candidacy, a pure base, rile the base up candidacy, which is essentially what Trump is running on the Republican side, you could try to make a case for Georgia and Texas. But the problem is if you run heavy towards turning out the liberal coalition in those states, you would weaken your ability, so goes the theory, in the six states that are closest, and that's another reason they picked these six, that have a more mixed electorate as the Times sees it and most people see it.
Emily, last question on this topic. So John Chait in New York Magazine, some subsection of New York Magazine, I can't remember which one, concludes that the leftward tilt of the Democratic candidates is turning out to be a disaster, that they've lost touch with median voters. They desperately need to get back to the center before they find themselves with an unelectable candidate. Is it the case that Warren and Sanders are essentially giving themselves iron crosses? They've hung iron crosses around their neck for the general election. I find myself wishing that Warren had not come up with a Medicare for All tax plan, like really wish that she had just said, you know, it'll be magic, which is what Republicans say all the time about their plans. It's always like, oh, it'll be magic, economic growth, magic. Do you think that she'll be able to run away from that? Or is it really something that is going to drag her?
I mean, people move to the ideological edge of their parties in primaries, right? Republicans move to the right, Democrats move to the left. The idea is then you tack back to the center in the general election. There's plenty of time. I do wonder about what these candidates are thinking in terms of not sticking with the most popular positions. Now, obviously, Warren wants to be able to attract Bernie Sanders voters and, you know, with zero reporting, you could imagine that she is trying to make sure that if and when Sanders drops out, he full-throatedly endorses her, and so she becomes the candidate of the full left. I also think she believes in Medicare for All. And yet, there is so much that these Democratic candidates could do for healthcare or, for example, on immigration with a path to citizenship that is broadly popular, that one wonders whether it would be politically wiser to stick to those positions. I mean, this is a question that people like Matt Iglesias at Vox have been asking for months. And when they, you know, put up the poll numbers every time, it looks pretty persuasive to me as just a matter of pragmatic politics.
What looks persuasive?
That sticking with broadly popular positions right. that are more right. centrist and that actually could become right. law would be smarter. Like, we are not going right. to immediately have Medicare for All. So we're having – they're taking – Warren and Sanders, particularly Warren, are taking a big political risk for something that doesn't seem particularly reality-based. And so then is it really necessary?
Right. Well, so this is, as you quite rightly pointed out, this is always the problem with primaries. It's why people have think that primaries are part of the reason our politics are so messed up, because everybody has to get into a very not only far left, but also detached debate as a kind of way to signal to their electorates that they are more pure than the next person. To your point, Emily, about what the environment's going to look like a year from now, let's imagine a Democrat wins. Okay, so Democrat wins. If they win, it will have been on a restoration ticket, which is to say, well, we're going to fix things post-Donald Trump. That gives you a huge to-do list just to start the day, okay? Before you get to Medicare for All, you've got a lot of stuff to do to restore. And by the way, most of it's going to be overseas and some large portion of it's going to be secret. So there's that. Second of all, the intervening election over the year, the next year, is going to be scorched earth. So how you're going to get this through a Medicare for All through Congress, even through trying to use reconciliation after that year, seems more unlikely than it even would be today. As you quite rightly said, Emily, you go to the left or the right in your primaries and come back to the middle. But that also depends on politics has changed a little bit in terms of the public square when you can make that case that you're not exactly the person you ran in the primaries as being. It's harder to do that now. Secondly, which of these candidates has the facility and ability to make that case, or do they keep stepping on their shoes tied together? And so that's one question. Can they even get back to that position? And then the question is, what do you guys think that position looks like in a general election for a Democrat to either undermine the president's coalition or to build success in areas like the suburbs where you've seen some of these opportunities for Democrats?
All right. I cannot let this segment pass, John, without noting what is surely the most important electoral result from Tuesday. Surprising result out of New Haven, Connecticut, which just elected a 19-year-old. A 19-year-old is one of its alders. And this 19-year-old won a staggering 90% of the vote. What do you make overwhelming mandate won by Eli Sabin, whose mother is noted political commentator Emily Bazelon? Just how significant do you feel this victory is for the future of the Republic?
Well, fortunately, for all those people who feel jittery about the state of the future and the state of the Republic, really about whether there is verifiable truth in these troubled times that we live in now, I think not just the people in the quiet suburbs of New Haven and the urban centers of that city, but also really across the country and the world can find themselves sleeping easier now as a result of that outcome.
Emily, mazel tov. Congratulations on your son's victory.
Thank you. My son is now in our city council, so it's going to be really interesting to watch. Eli is so excited and thrilled.
We, GabFest listeners, have our annual Conundrum show coming up live at the Fox Theater in Oakland, California on December 18th and have a very exciting announcement, which we have a great guest. As you know, every year we try to get a very wise, philosophical-minded person to help us solve Conundra for you. This year, no different. We have an amazing guest. Adam Savage of Mythbusters is going to join us at the Fox Theater on December 18th. No one has done a keener analysis of the true questions Americans fret about the real myths and blowing up the real myths. He's so funny and smart and interesting, and I'm so excited he's going to join us. So you can still get tickets for that show at slate.com/live to see us tackle conundrums with Adam Savage. Again, slate.com/live, December 18th in Oakland. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. Public hearings on impeachment are expected to begin on Wednesday in front of the House Intelligence Committee, featuring witnesses who have already testified behind closed doors. Impeachment, it seems to me, is circling around two main tracks. First track is, are Democrats moving fast enough and with enough clarity to maintain and even build public support for the process and harm the president, undermine the president, undermine Republicans, even if they don't break the Republican firewall and actually remove him from office? Second, there is this kind of process question, which is what is going to happen in this massive showdown between legislature and presidency over testimony, tax return, privileges, witnesses, and how is the judicial branch going to referee that, if at all? John, let's start with the substance of the week. So there's always a ton of impeachment news these days. Some of the news this week was that Gordon Sondland, the ambassador to the EU, who had been engaged in the shadow of foreign policy along with Rudy Giuliani, conceded, he reversed himself. He essentially said, I misled Congress earlier when I said I did not talk about a quid pro quo, but there was a quid pro quo whereby we were telling the Ukrainians they had to launch this investigation of the Bidens in order to free up the military aid that Congress had appropriated. So that was a big deal. There was this talk of a press conference that Bill Barr did not hold. There, on Thursday, as we're taping, one of Mike Pence's key aides is testifying. What in your mind are the key substantive things that happened with impeachment this week?
I think Sondland was the biggest news because Sondland said he told Ukrainian officials that military aid was tied to their commitment to the president. Sondland, as you'll remember, had plenty of conversations with the president about this. Adam Schiff scheduled, I think, also the first impeachment hearing, which is on the 15th of November. I think what is still at issue, and Republicans are trying to close ranks. The president has hired some people to help him with his impeachment defense. What is still at issue, and is very hard to put a finger on, is whether the argument is that the president did not try to use his job to influence the government of Ukraine to look into Joe Biden, that he didn't do it at all, or that he did it, but it's not impeachable. There's also a third kind of nutty thing, which is he did it, but because Ukraine didn't launch the investigation into Biden, it doesn't matter, which Emily will tell me if this is right or wrong. But that's not the way the law works. And also in Nixon's case, some of the things that drove him for office never came to pass.
It's risible, that particular defense.
Right. One lawyer said the only way you can claim that defense is if what you are originally plotting to do is actually impossible. So build a ray gun in your backyard that uses marshmallows and golf balls as its primary source of energy.
Wait, that's impossible?
To shoot down your neighbor.
That.
God
damn it.
David was but about here's... to do that this afternoon.
Right,
come
exactly.
on.
But I think, John, the thing that makes me so despondent about all of this is that the record of the Trump presidency seems to be that the partisan divide is so strong that he'll get away with this, and that people's memories are so short, and there are so many outrages that happen every week in this presidency that people are like, can't even believe. I mean, I can't even, you know, what Michael Cohen's testimony. I mean, every month there's something which is like, wow, this is really the breaking point. This is shocking. No one will accept this. Like, look what has been conceded on the record that he's now done, and it doesn't stick. And he so has lowered standards so much, and he is thrown so much right. chaff out there, and there's so much confusion and so much willingness to accept misbehavior on his part by his supporters that people are frustrated and they are disillusioned and disengaged. And I sorry, just to pile on this point, one last point. Last week we were talking about, oh, there's going to be mass protest, or where is the mass protest? Why is there not mass protest? That was the subject of last week. We're just 6 days later, and there's been that whole topic is gone. The idea that mass protests would come out of this is gone.
It could come back.
I don't know. I don't know. People have moved into a state of disillusion and inaction because they're so frustrated because the president has done such a good job of destroying the integrity of the political system and making people doubt truth and doubt whether they can get anything done.
But David, don't you think there's more public support for impeachment? It's just that there's also this hardcore of Trump supporters who are not budging.
I think you have to sort things into their boxes here a little bit. So first of all, Democrats in the elections that just took place, everything I read suggests that actually one of the challenges for Republicans is that Donald Trump seems to be an incredible motivator and turnout mechanism for Democratic voters. If the best turnout mechanism for your base is the president, then it allows candidates to spend some time reaching into parts of the electorate that are not a part of their base. I think the impeachment process, to the extent that it goes forward, and you are a Republican senator who has to vote, do I think it's going to lead to the president's impeachment? I think everything you have said and everything we've seen and the tribal reaction we've seen to run down people of good standing in order to defend the president whose behavior, whether it's impeachable or not, certainly breaks many of the standards that a lot of the politicians have spent their careers saying must be maintained or will lead to the destruction of American life and culture. So I think the fact that people have held tight for partisan reasons, you have to bet on that. So I don't think there's anything that suggests that the Senate is going to vote to remove him. But the process going forward, I think, does put, again, some of those, particularly senators who are up for re-election, and each of them in a position where they have to, if they do say, look, this is bad but not impeachable, then they do at some point have to answer, okay, but since you admit that it happened but it's not impeachable, you're also saying it's okay that the president lied and that's bad but not impeachable. I think to just have people on the record, that's a useful thing to happen. Where and how it leads, we don't know. But it's good to have people on the record about what the standards are and whether this president has exceeded them or fallen below them.
I just want to say that I hold open a window for Republican senators shifting positions in light of these public hearings. Public hearings mattered a lot in Watergate, and I just want to keep the possibility open that they could matter again, even though we live in a much more polarized time, both in our politics and in our media.
Emily, let's talk about some of these process questions, which I know you've thought about. You have a piece in the Times about it. There's a huge question about whether the House is going to be able to compel people associated with the president, his closest aides, to testify or to supply any key documents. For the moment, they seem to be saying, forget it, we're not going to bother. We're not going to go through the legal process to try to get this, even though maybe we have the right to get it, just because it will take too long. Where do you see this showdown going? Or maybe there'll be no showdown.
So I think that the Democrats are playing it smart right now. And what I mean by that is that you're right. Congress has this right to investigate. It has this power. It's had it since the founding. Since the Nixon era, presidents have been increasingly asserting what's called executive privilege more boldly over more material. Executive privilege just means there's supposed to be some private zone of confidential communications in the White House for the president so he can communicate with candor with his aides. Like, that makes sense. We don't know how far that zone extends. There is actually very little court precedent from this. The Supreme Court has actually never had a case in which it had to decide between the power of Congress to subpoena witnesses and evidence and the president's right to claim executive privilege. We just don't know the answer. What has been remarkable, although not really surprising, about the Trump administration is they are claiming absolute immunity for any witness who doesn't want to testify. So it's not like we want to litigate whether a specific set of material or set of questions are covered by executive privilege. It's Don McGahn, former White House counsel, doesn't even need to show up. That litigation is all happening outside of the parameters of the impeachment inquiry because I think Adam Schiff and whoever else is making these decisions for the Democrats is seeing that litigation take a long time and is saying, no, we're not going to get dragged into long court battles. And so there was this interesting detail that John helpfully noted for me this week where we had a lawsuit from this guy, Charles Kupperman, who's a John Bolton aide, has the same lawyer as John Bolton. And he had taken it upon himself to go to court himself and say, I'm caught between these two competing demands. Congress is telling me to show up and the president is telling me not to. And I don't know what to do. And I'm suing both of them. And the Congress withdrew the subpoena of Kupperman this week, saying basically, like, you don't want to come. This is going to take too long. We're not getting waylaid by this. And you can see that as like Congress folding its tent. But given just the time parameters of this kind of litigation, I think it was the right call. And so I think you're right. We may basically avoid a showdown in the courts. And what Congress is counting on and what is working really well so far is that if you have a willing witness, it's not at all clear that executive privilege is a sword that Trump can wield. And so as long as the people who are career professionals and Trump appointees like Gordon Sondland want to keep coming up and giving this damning testimony against the president, I think that Congress is going to forego the witnesses who don't want to come. The most interesting witness we don't know the answer to so far is John Bolton himself. He's had a lot of obviously direct communication with Trump. He is in the middle of this. One could imagine that some of the leaks involving the damning evidence against Trump relate to Bolton and his people, but we just don't know whether he's going to comply with a subpoena yet.
Emily, can we just put to bed this funny notion? And as you say, it's laughable, but man, it's getting a lot of people who are in jobs of preventing the president making this argument. The argument that, well, yes, he was trying to influence Ukraine, but since they weren't influenced, it's not wrong. We've already talked about why that's not. But in law, the reason that's not the case, the reason we don't want that to be the case is because we don't want to incentivize people to make attempts. Is that correct, Emily Bazelon?
Yes, it is. John Dickerson, attempted murder is its own crime. And we want attempted murder to be a crime because we don't want you to be able to try to kill someone and fail for reasons that were outside of your control, like you're a really bad shot or whatever. And that is still a crime, and we want to be able to
treat it. Shoe bomber is spending life in prison. Last time I checked. And,
when you think about it, it's kind of an odd distinction because from the point of view, if you really think someone tried to kill someone and they didn't succeed, like, who cares? They're just as culpable. But we do make that distinction. I mean, think about drunk driving. If you get caught driving drunk but you don't hurt someone, that is a lesser charge, a lesser penalty than if you hurt someone. But you're taking the same risk in both situations.
That is a really good question. Wait, philosophically, are you... Mm-hmm.
I've got another one.
No, but do you guys think that attempting something and failing is as bad as attempting and succeeding? Like, for example, if you wanted to hire, you could be arrested for trying to hire a contract killer and failing because the contract killer actually is an FBI informant, and so it never happens. But there are all sorts of steps, even after you've hired your contract killer, where you could have said to your contract killer, you know what, I regret that. Let's not do that. And so actually you would have had a chance to stop it. So maybe, like, doing things which you don't fully follow through on, it does seem like you shouldn't be punished as much as things you fully follow through on. Drunk driving is an interesting case because it's kind of out of your control whether you fully follow through on it.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this question, Emily, which is that would the sentencing change if you, as the attempted murderer or attempted bank robber, had a special community position that you were running afoul of? So if you were a policeman and you tried to kill a relative.
A possession of trust and authority in the government, John?
There you go. Would that change the sentencing? And then if you were to come up with a scale of people who have a special stewardship and trust in the government, where would you rank the president on maintaining that trust in that ranking?
Oh, I would rank the president high since he is our commander-in-chief. And yeah, we definitely have laws where if you're in the government and you abuse your position of trust, that is its own crime. I mean, this is just, I don't know what to say. Like, there's a way in which one of the most revealing parts of all of this are the lengths, the arguments that people who are defending Trump are willing to make, the lengths to which they are willing to go. And I think, obviously, that's the broader point you're making. And, you know, David's right. It is succeeding to a dismaying degree. Like, even if it doesn't persuade most of the country, it is enough for lots of people who just want to look past this conduct.
And some people say to even raise the questions that people are using in bad faith to defend the president is to give them energy. And I'm sympathetic to that because I've been, saying forever that fact-checking gives energy to the underlying lie, even if you think you're doing your right duty. But I do think in this case, one of the things at issue with any president, and this one in particular, is whether the lengths to which people will go to defend you, because the presidency is an honored post in American life, and we should all, in some very vague sense, rush to the defense of a president. Obviously, a job created with fear of monarchy wouldn't want that as its single qualification. But I'm saying there is a rallying around a president that is a part of the tradition, and therefore, when you do something as a president, knowing that rallying effect takes place, you are messing with a public trust here. So there is in these defenses and the extremity of the defenses, it's actually also part, it seems to me, of the case. Because when you're a president, your actions are not cabined by the thing you did on a single phone call. They have all of these other effects, which is a part of your job in your office. And all of those effects are built into the office. So you need to think about it quite broadly, it seems to me. It doesn't mean that you need to impeach or that you need to convict. But it means that it's much more than a single phone call, and it includes to the crazy things people may say in your defense that have no basis in the human world that we exist in and breathe in today.
Slate Plus members get bonus segments on the GabFest and other Slate podcasts. So if you go to slate.com/GabFestPlus, you can become a member of Slate Plus today. All you Gen Z Slate Plus members, all you Boomer Slate Plus members, all you Gen Y Slate Plus members, and even all you not millennial, those are Gen Y, all the Gen Xers like me and John and Emily. We're going to talk about OK Boomer. So you're going to get a we're going to start some generational warfare, and you get that as your bonus segment today.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
The president announced that the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord, official announcement. This is the 2015 global agreement asking for voluntary emissions reductions by most of the nations of the world. The president announced the withdrawal on the first day that the United States could announce its legal withdrawal from this. The withdrawal will not take effect for 1 year, so not until November 4th, 2020, the day after the presidential election. So under any circumstance, the U.S. will be withdrawn from this treaty for at least some period of time. Presumably a new president could put us back into it, but we will be withdrawn for a bit. Emily, it's kind of not a surprise. I mean, the president has rolled back emission standards for cars. He's loosened standards for coal plants. He's gutted subsidies for renewables. You name it, he has done it when it comes to weakening protections for the climate and undermining attempts to decrease emissions. So is this actually important that he's doing this?
Yeah, it's important. This is the worldwide climate agreement that's supposed to get countries moving towards saving the planet. You know, the saving grace of this is that he had to give a year's notice. And so this will actually go into effect the day after the 2020 elections, which means that if Trump is not reelected, it could effectively be stopped. And it puts into stark relief the choice that voters will be facing and making in November about the United States and whether it's going to be responsible in its reaction to climate change and whether it's going to join with other nations in this like incredibly crucial collective enterprise.
So when it comes to something like this, though, so the Paris Accord, I think there are two different kinds of critiques of it. One, the critique from the right is this just really hurts American interests and hurts American competitiveness, and it's other countries taking advantage of America and wrecking our economic growth. That's the one side. And from the left, this is weak tea. It's a voluntary set of goals. It's not, there are no requirements. Why does it even matter? Because no one even has to hit it. Why is it important despite those two critiques?
Well, you just got to start somewhere. I mean, collective action has to collect and cohere around something. And once you build the formulations and the structure for agreement, then you can ratchet things up. We've also seen since the original agreement, the targets, which I believe are 2 degrees Celsius, we're now at 1 degree increase. And in some parts of the world, I think in a quarter of the globe, it's already 1.5. The problem has gotten worse by the targets of the original measurement. So that's a problem and creates that sense of urgency. But if you don't have something that gets everybody around the table and works towards these goals, even if they're somewhat voluntary, then you have to kind of start all over again, which is what we're talking about. If there's a new president, they would have to start all over again, which I would just interject quickly in terms of a turnout mechanism for younger voters in particular, for whom this is a voting issue, which again gives a Democratic candidate some wiggle room, because if they're going to turn out because you can make the case, look, climate's really going to be screwed if you don't elect a Democrat, then that gives a Democratic presidential candidate some wiggle room with other parts of the constituency that they need to work harder
on. Although I would argue the counter of that, John, which is that the conservative position and the Trump position has kind of morphed in a subtle way. It's not really so much this isn't happening. The full-throated denials, the kind of bogus denials which they've pushed forward, have vanished. And instead, it's moved into what I think is a more effective set of messaging, which is you just say Green New Deal, AOC, socialists, wreck the economy, crush jobs. And that, I don't know, that's more effective as a turnout mechanism for the right than what you just described is for young voters on the left. But it is I think it's a better argument because it's more realistic and it does have it almost puts numbers on something. It says, oh, yeah, these guys are trying to destroy this strong industry that we have and take away American jobs and take away jobs in timber and in fracking and in petro industry.
It's so short-sighted, though. Oh, I can't help.
Yes,
I have to interrupt
yes,
you. I
yes.
mean, come on.
I don't endorse
right?
this. Yes, go ahead.
No,
sing
I
it,
know.
Sister.
I just can't stand to keep hearing it for so long. We already, even in our denialist or skeptic economy, we already are employing twice as many people in solar as we are in coal in the United States. Meanwhile, though, we're letting China just have this market. So this is from a John Kerry and Chuck Hagel op-ed. For every dollar the United States invests in renewable energy, China is putting in three. We're just ceding this whole territory, even as the cost of producing air and wind is coming way, way down. And that kind of renewable energy is competitive. There is a huge economic
yes.
opportunity
yes.
here. And
if you think about it as an economic question, not simply just, green, cushy, green silliness. It's actually economics. This is where jobs are. This is where economic opportunity is. This is where growth is. And it's demoralizing as hell that these people who claim to believe in economic growth and claim to believe in innovation in the future are just throwing it away. It's maddening.
It seems to me if you have younger voters who care about this issue and are going to vote on it and be propelled by it, then what it does is it frees you up to make precisely the case you're making and that Walmart is making and that all of these individual companies that have joined together to push behavior that is renewable and that supports wind and solar, that you can make that case to say suburban voters. You can say, look, this isn't about this is about the economic future and development of the United States. It's not just about these, fuzzy lefty ideas. These are smart economic decisions to make about America's future. It seems to me you have lots of free market private enterprise people who would join you and who would buy that argument. This is going to be an incredibly negative election, so I think there's going to be so much uglier things said about Democrats to caricature them or characterize them that climate actually probably wouldn't, they'll do uglier things first.
Yeah, but then we also have to take into account the disproportionate political power of the people who could be losers from this economic
right.
shift, right? So it's the manufacturing center. It's people in Kentucky and West Virginia and Pennsylvania who are still involved in coal mining and other extractive industries. And those folks really matter in the Electoral College.
What I don't understand
right.
is the people.
And where the issue is a proxy for what they.
Yeah,
think.
But you
yes.
know the people who live in Miami. Like if you think about Florida, that's a big state. People who live in Georgia, Florida is a state that may well not exist in its substantive form in 50 years. If you live in Miami, you own any real estate in Miami, and you're not incredibly concerned about climate change, you're a fucking moron. And so I just don't – I don't understand. If you own any beachfront
– I don't subscribe to that particular
any beachfront
view,
property, if you own
record.
Any beachfront property on the East Coast, if you're on coastal North Carolina and you're a voter, if you're on coastal Georgia and you're a voter, if you're anywhere in coastal Florida and you're a voter, and you're not thinking about that as an issue, you're just wanting to give away your most, valuable asset and the thing that, brings you probably the most joy. So I find it – yes, you should. Yes, the Kentucky voter, the West Virginia voter, the Pennsylvania voter who works in coal country. Sure,
well,
they're valuable. But these there are tons of people who are going to be affected by climate change. You know, if you're in Colorado and there are droughts that are hitting you and that you cannot farm the way you wanted to farm, people need to be attuned to their economic interests and think, oh, yeah, that's actually an important voting issue for me, which they're not right now.
Right. But But if we look at those six states we talked about earlier, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Arizona, only Florida and North Carolina fit in the basket that you're talking about. So if you were having to make a calculation of what your overall position was that swept in as many states as possible, I think you would have to be more worried about how that message would be received in manufacturing-centered states more than coastal states, particularly if you're a Democrat and you're coastal. At least I think this, you know, your coastal votes may already be with you in Florida.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
All right, let us go to cocktail chatter. When you're sitting in your beachfront property on the deck watching the waves lap up ever closer, ever closer, ever closer, what are you going to be chattering about as you drink an elegiac cocktail, Emily Bazelon?
I am so distressed this week about a story that colleges and universities have been buying the names of high school kids who take the SAT and don't look like strong enough candidates to get into said colleges and universities. But the colleges and universities reach out to them and market to them and make it seem like, hey, you have a good shot. And then they reject them. What is the point of doing this? The schools do it to drive up their selectivity rates because that helps them in the horrible but powerful U.S. News and World Report rankings that continue to sort of stalk us like a terrible ghost of U.S. News and World Report, which otherwise I feel like doesn't even exist anymore. Who knows? And then there's also the cost to these students and their families, the psychological toll of applying to schools that actually you don't have a shot at getting into, and then the actual cost of paying the application fees. The whole thing just makes me ill, and it is just one more nail in the coffin for the SAT, which I would just be so happy if we got rid of it forever.
John Dickerson, what's your chatter?
My chatter is kind of twofold, but I was reading a piece about going to Mars in The Independent about how long it would take and all the things that would have to be taken into account. And it seemed completely obvious after reading it, but wasn't to me in my initial thinking about it, that, you know, 3 years on a ship to Mars and back, you're going to have to handle all your own surgery and like even small, like kidney stones could become fatal in that environment where you're basically in a tin can for 3 years. And so anyway, I tweeted that not incredible revelation, but anyway, and Paul McGrain said it reminded him of a story that you guys probably already know, but that I don't think I knew, but which is about the Soviet doctor who was in Antarctica in 1960, Leonid Rogozov, who had to perform his own appendectomy because there was not a doctor or even a medical station for 1,000 miles, and the snow was blowing. And anyway, so basically, he had to use some Novocaine and a mirror and two friends, one of whom was, I think, a meteorologist, and the other was a driver, to basically help him do surgery on himself. And when he opened up his stomach, he found that, in fact, the appendix was about ready to blow. So he probably would have had one more day before it would have blown, and then I think it would have been impossible. That's a pretty amazing thing, to do surgery on yourself and be successful, which he was. He had apparently to stop at various intervals while he was doing it because he got a little woozy, which, you know, fair enough. But that was an amazing story of the human spirit.
Yeah.
That's my chatter.
My chatter. I'll double dip a little bit. First of all, I want to alert everyone, if you are a Philip Pullman fan, you have probably heard that his Dark Materials is now a TV show from the BBC and HBO. So HBO started airing his Dark Materials, which is Pullman's trilogy. Amazing. My favorite books. I've talked about them before on the show. And the HBO series, there's an 8-episode start, which is just the first book, The Golden Compass. And the first episode ran this week. It's great. And it's apparently, from those who've seen the whole thing, it's going to be better. So check that out. But also,
do Pullman, you promise? Because I am afraid to watch this. I'm so attached to these books. I never watched the movie, and I'm only going to watch it if you really guarantee
it's good. It's good. It's really good. They're not as good as the books. I mean, the books are unassailably great, but it is much, much better than the movie. And it's so far, it seems good. I'll watch a little further and let you know. Also, his Pullman.
I feel like you took a little back on that.
Well, it's too soon to tell. It's only, you know, the first hour of 8 have I watched. But also, right, Pullman's right. Second book in his second trilogy. So he's writing it. He wrote his Dark Materials trilogy, and now he's writing a second trilogy called The Book of Dust. The first book came out a couple of years ago.
It was called bad.
La Belle Sauvage, and was terrible. And now the second book.
Oh, I didn't think it was terrible. Oof,
no, it's bad, John.
It's really bad.
Like, so unworthy of the first trilogy.
Well, that's different. It's different whether it's unworthy of the trilogy or just objectively bad.
Anyway, the second book, The Secret Commonwealth, just came out. I think it's coming out. I don't know. I got my hands on an early copy, maybe. And it's really good. It's not quite as good as his Dark Materials, but it's really good. It catches Lyra at a wonderful moment. It returns to Lyra. It catches Lyra at 20. 19 maybe, and she's a college student, and then all sorts of events from her past are coming back to interrupt her, and it's really interesting on her relationship with Pan now that they're adults, and it's got a lot of the
That's
adventure.
Her Damon.
Demon. It's Demon. So it's good. So check it out. The other thing, it's just a little bit of self-involved chatter, which is, I don't think I've talked about this before, but I am looking for my next thing. So I'm going to be leaving Atlas Obscura. We're hunting for a new CEO. If you know a great person who could be CEO of Atlas Obscura, let me know. But I'm going to be handing the reins off there and doing something new. And I'm starting to think about what that would be. And maybe you have a great idea for me. The only constraint is that it has to be something I can do from Washington primarily. So if you have a great idea, please just send me an email at the GabFest email address, gabfest@slate.com, and I would love to hear your wonderful idea. Listeners, you sent us excellent chatters yourselves this week. Please keep them coming. Tweet to us at @SlateGabFest with your wonderful article or piece of culture or song or historical episode, whatever it is. And this week, it was a very David Plotzy kind of listener chatter that I'm going to call out. It's from @ShahofShaw. And it's a story that ran in CNN, but probably ran elsewhere, about a boat that was trapped above Niagara Falls 100 years ago, in 1918, 101 years ago. It was a kind of an iron boat that in the midst of a storm got trapped. They had to rescue the two people who were on the boat, and the boat got lodged on a rock about 600 feet above the falls, and it just stuck there. It was there for 100 years, and this week it moved. It hadn't moved in 100 years, and it dislodged and moved around, and it's now come to a different resting place above the falls. I think it's above the falls. No one wants to mess with it. No one wants to get near it because it's too risky. But I love the idea that this thing is just sitting there for 100 years and then decides, because there's a particularly violent storm, a lot of wind and rain, and it's like, all right, I'm going to move now. So nice story from Shaw of Shaw. That is our.
It's a metaphor for our times.
It is.
It's a serious anthropomorphizing of a rock that you just did.
Boat.
It's going to move.
A boat.
Boat. Whatever.
Yeah. Well, we give them names. And actually, the Philip Pullman book, the last one, was called La Belle Sauvage, which is the name of the boat. It was a book about a boat.
And as we agreed, it was a terrible book.
It was a terrible book. That is our show for today. The Political Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Gabriel Roth is editorial director. And June Thomas is managing producer of Slate Podcast. Alan Peng in New York. Ryan McAvoy in New Haven. And Melissa Kaplan here in D.C. helped engineer the show. You should follow us on Twitter @SlateGabFest. Tweet chatter to us and come to our live show on December 18th at the Fox Theater in Oakland, California. annual Conundrum Show with Adam Savage as our guest host. Go to slate.com/live for tickets for Emily Bazelon, mother of a city council member, and Alder in New Haven, and John Dickerson, father of dragons. I'm David Blotz. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? I don't know what age you are, Slate Plus. I'm guessing you're more likely to be in the millennial or Gen X age bracket. So you're probably in the kind of 30 to 55 age bracket, judging just a guess, because also that's where John and Emily and I all are. But I don't know. Maybe you're not. Maybe you're 16 years old. Maybe you're 73 years old. I don't know. But this week we had this very funny generational meme that is now spread around. Okay, Boomer. Why is okay? What is okay, Boomer, Emily? Why is it? Why is it? And why did it catch the imagination?
Oh no, you're asking me.
Or I can explain.
I was the last to hear about this. Okay. Yeah, you explain.
Okay, so essentially, it's a lovely kind of dismissive, tossed-off phrase that Gen Z folks, I don't know where you define Gen Z. It's like sort of sub 25, maybe sub 30 folks are saying as a way to deflate the smugness of the old. And it's aimed at boomers, but I guess it also probably encompasses us. We are sub boomers. And the notion is these older people are often telling the young, to learn something, stop being so sensitive, stop being so woke, stop criticizing us, stop talking about subjects you don't understand, you're too young to understand. And this is a quick, excellent little dismissive phrase that popped up as a way to give the back of the hand to old people. And it's just caught on very quickly. I'm sure it will explode and die very quickly too, in the way that these things do. But everyone all of a sudden was talking about it and enjoying it. And even you got this great spectacle of baby boomers saying it was ageism, and that saying this to somebody was a form of age-based harassment, and you should file an EEOC complaint about it. So, John, then, is this a, you know, why do people get agitated about it and fun, have, why are they having such fun with it?
Well, because we are in an age of constant agitation. And by the way, one of the generational claims against the boomers was that they were so self-involved that they couldn't get past themselves and see anything larger, which is what kept them in gated communities, walled off from the greatest generation. And so some people see in their thin-skinned reaction to OK Boomer evidence of the original claims against boomers, which is that they were totally self-obsessed and that basically they should relax and recognize that this is basically just a new form of the sort of get off my lawn critique, which is, you know, basically you're like a cranky old, and cranky olds are sometimes out of touch. A new New Zealand lawmaker, Chloe Swarbrick, was giving a speech about climate change and a climate crisis bill, and it was heckled by an older member of parliament, and she deployed this okay boomer and then kept talking. But she did it in kind of unfazed, you know, she just like dropped it in and then moved on. It was well deployed, because now the problem is it's become such a thing that to successfully deploy it has to actually, it seems to me, account for all of the irony required by the fact that it's now been discussed so much. I mean, just if you want to be really clever.
Is there any legitimacy to generational warfare? I mean, I'm generally...
GabFest fans, that was just a teaser. To hear the rest of our Slate Plus conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today.